Welcome to the 119th JBST.com Smartcast, released for September 2013. This is the multi-sport podcast for triathletes, duathletes, sportive riders, road racers, time trialists, runners, mountain bikers, and fitness enthusiasts.
So whatever your event...
He's forgotten.
Oh, Go on. So whatever your distance and whatever your event, this podcast aims to make you smarter and faster. I've only done it 12 times.
Thank you for downloading this 119th episode. Thank you, Martin Crocker, for that excellent introduction. I'm joined once again by Crocker from Southport Racing, which is Twitter at Southport Racing.
That's right.
So, how are you? What are you?
I am all right, and I'm okay.
Good.
So, no, not too bad. Thank you, Joseph. And yourself?
I am good.
Good.
Yes, we are on the verge of the, I would say, the last throws of the season.
That's it. And
The Vuelta is on. There is, what, about 5 or 6 weeks to...
Till Christmas.
If you're listening to this at the end of November, yeah. It could be.
Panic.
There is the World Championships in London, which is 2 weeks away.
That's right.
There's Kona Ironman, which is 5 weeks away. So there's still lots of racing to do. There's still quite a few people racing, stretching the seasons out.
Good.
We had a most recent rating at iTunes from a Scott Nova Raiders. I don't know what that means. That's just what it said. And it was on the 10th of August. And he says, well worth downloading. Loads of tips on training and equipment and nutrition. I've got it now.
Bed posture.
Best podcast out there. So he's talking about somebody else, obviously.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Scott.
Yes. Is it Scott? I guess. I don't know what Nova Raiders is. Know what Nova Raiders is?
Well, unless it's a reference to Canada.
Could be. Okay. News. What news have you got? Come on. It's just about... Well, it's actually... I had communication today with somebody at Eurobike, so Eurobike is on.
It is indeed.
What have you heard? What do you know? Go and say something useful at this point, please.
Not a lot. Obviously, everything's out with new 11-speed Shimano bits and bobs, so there's a new 11-speed Altegra group set, which, funny enough, we've got in stock already. An 11-speed, obviously...
Does it have bar-end shifters?
It's not electronic. This is mechanical.
Oh, sorry.
11-speed mechanical.
That was me just thinking, brand new, it must be electronic. So 11-speed mechanical.
Mechanical, which is fantastic.
Is that what they call it, actually, when Shimano, you know, bods come to see you, like...
Like Rob Pink.
Rob Pink.
Sir Rob Pink.
Sir Rob Pink, yeah. MBE, OBE, yeah. CBE.
All mechanical.
TCP. Yeah, but that's what they call it, mechanical. Yeah, mechanical. So there's mechanical and electronic.
Yeah, and DOT.
I'd have thought they'd have called it, like, you know... traditional,
yeah, like the GS3 or something like that, but no, it is just mechanical. Obviously disc brakes coming on road bikes as standard this year. I say as standard, you have a choice of when you have them in what range, so whether it be 105 Altegra, Dura-Race, etc. So there's coming.
So Shimano do those?
Shimano have, but then this is, most of it is mechanical, so it needs a cable to pull it, and some of it is hydraulic activated, yeah. But there's a little issue, I think, with the calipers on those. But so you've got 11-speed Shimano, obviously the 11-speed SRAM as well. We've seen most of the new bikes for the brands, so some of that will be arriving mid-September, believe it or not. As it stands now, this is kind of when it's a bit of a crossover, really, from when kind of the triathlon season kind of finishes, and then all the new kit comes out, and everybody's like, oh, what? I can get to race on it now until maybe March or April. So, yeah, it's a good time. It's a good time at the minute. So we're looking forward to all the new stuff.
Yeah, and there will be, you know, for those that perhaps are new to this whole annual cycle thing, you know, this is where you go in your off season, and just I think just you know go to websites. There's loads of them. I think it's Cycling PRSS is one that I've just found recently, and they do lots of different news pieces from all around. So you get it pulls it all in.
I mean,
in.
Cycling News is another one cycling as well. News, you've got Road Radar, CC as well.
Road.cc. Yeah. Velo News. Yeah. They have a lot of pictures of all the different. They've got a tech bit where they get you know all the different pictures, and they'll all be doing Eurobike, Interbike, right. All the different shows, and you'll see you know things popping up which have already been tested. There was already. The underground shots of the you know the bikes that people were using on the tour and continue to use throughout most triathlons and road races. It's just people don't always notice that they're on something different.
Yeah.
They're definitely testing new things all the time, and that's across all of the sports. There's new running shoes coming out which already been you know people have been tested and they're starting to see them trickle down through. So yeah, this is the crossover. It may be that 2014 appears now, but it's for most people visible. I suppose it's quite quick, but they don't really think about it at the moment, so they don't really notice it in all of the ads until next year, though it's actually there's already sneak peeks of stuff.
But then saying that, I'm of a particular track of mind where 2013 has to finish. There's got to be a definite before you even think about 2014. But anyway, from a retail point of view, there's going to be loads of stuff out there that you'll see soon. But majority of it won't be available till the new year. But yeah. It's something to get people excited.
But it is that, you know, it's one of those things where it's probably good that people see it and think about it. Also look at their own equipment that they've got and actually work out, is it a viable upgrade? Is it something whereby, only had somebody today that said, oh yeah, I'd left my chain on my bike for 18 months. I'm new to this. I've had to have, you know, new chain rings, sprockets, and on the rear cassette, depending on whether they call them sprockets, you know. People have
different... I think my dad does, yeah.
What do you call
cassette.
Them?
Yeah, cassette.
It's cassette, but what is each individual part of the cassette called?
A cog.
A cog?
Not a watch? What's the matter with you? No. They're sprockets, individual. Yeah,
but, so. You know, had to replace all of that because he didn't change his chain in 18 months. And actually said, oh, wow, what? I should be replacing it more often. You know, oh, yeah, that's why I've got a big bill for my,
for my
service and my bike. And so you realise that all this equipment is constantly changing. To keep on top of it takes some doing, and actually to work out other things you need to get that are just bread and butter things that may not be super sexy and attractive, but getting a new chain or sorting out tires or getting your running shoes kind of rethought of how many miles have I done in these. Ooh, too many, right, change them.
Another thing,
right, oh here we go, we haven't even started with
this is like the swimming kit as well.
Yeah,
you know,
you use that until it literally is threadbare, and you get.
This is the part I mean. When you get into the swimming pool, they may look all right on, but when you jump in the pool, they get wet, or you pull them a bit, they then go see through. I think that's it, isn't it? Really?
Yes,
chlorine's not a good thing, not for material anyway.
No,
but yeah, maybe get an honest opinion from someone in your family or a loved one, please. I've seen some hideous sights, but.
Okay, thank you for that. No, that was very interesting. but it is that thing that you know people get tempted by the new stuff, and often there are new things that do improve, or they offer improvement which somebody then can categorically say, yes, this you know particular tire or wetsuit or drink or whatever is you know this much better, or is as good, or has been refined. But there's plenty of things that people get that they think are going to make a big difference. And they don't really. But you've got to buy, even if you've got kit at the moment, you think you've got all the kit you need, that kit, still running shoes, bike chains, swim goggles, it all needs to be eventually turned over to a point where you say, actually, that's getting near the end of its life. Right, that's the spare pair, or that's the spare tyre, or that's going to be thrown away. Don't keep things until they fail on you at the wrong time.
That's the thing, isn't it? You know, with goggles, I can think goggles are... relatively inexpensive. I know you can pay up, you know, quite a princely sum, but you know, if you've got a moderate pair of glasses, goggles that are £20, you know, going, oh, strap looks a bit ropey on that one. Oh, they'll be all right for this next event. As soon as you hit the water, they pop off. That's it. you know, for the sake of £20, or even a new strap, you know, you could have a look at it. But there
it's
we
all,
are.
It's all going to be new. It's all going to be out there. Yeah. You're going to see all the pictures. A lot of it pops up very, kind of often very, like, tantalisingly early. And then you see, like, you know, did anybody mention the word vector pedals? You know, eventually they pop up and they're there, but it took a long time, didn't it?
Yeah, but then if you're going to get it right first time. Don't mess about.
Okay, thanks for that.
No worries.
Right, in news, 70.3 Champs, which was on the television, did you see it?
Yeah.
Cat Morrison got third on the podium. Great race in the men's race. Richie Nichols, I think it's Frodeno. They ran 108.53 and 108.52 respectively. That's stonking.
Not bad, is it?
I mean, 68 minutes, half marathon, assuming it's, you know, bang on accurate, but still, other times looked about right, and they did 108s, and you think, that's moving somewhat.
That's shifting, isn't it?
That is shifting. What I did see later on in the day, was it on that? No, it was on that programme. They do these, what they're now calling the Aussie exits, where you have to get out of the water, run round the barriers, and get back in.
Yeah.
And some people were running right along the shore for as far as they could before they jumped back in. They didn't kind of come around the barrier and run straight into the water. They went right off at a tangent. So they go as long as they can running before then jumping in the water. And you think, that makes perfect sense. You either put a barrier to stop them doing it, or people are going to try and make, even if you make horizontal kind of progress, you're still making progress to dive in ahead of somebody that's had to already do, I don't know, 5 meters of swimming. I thought it was really interesting how you could see them running the widest that they could on the
but it's the same with things like mountain biking. You know, the rule is, if it's not taped, you can ride it. So you can, you know, if there's a piece of tape, a gap, then a piece of tape, and the shortest line is to cut underneath a tree rather than to go round it, you're allowed to do it. So you, in your mind already, you're always looking for that a bit of gain in performance. The same you would do tyres, you know, the next suits, the next pair of running shoes, or running tangents
where you absolutely run to the straightest point of each corner.
Because that would be an interesting thing to know, is knowing if you straight lined most things, you know, how much further would you...
Yeah,
would you run if you didn't do it? If you know what I mean? That would be quite interesting.
In the World Championships, the marathon, one of the runners was running on the inside of the line.
Yeah,
and I heard, I think it was Steve Cram. Said, are they meant to do that? And somebody said, no. They've got to stay on the side of the line. Inside of that line, technically, they're inside the course, and they're not actually allowed to do that. And I thought, yeah, sometimes you can see people. They kind of do bend the rules a bit, and there's quite a few instances where you think, oh, that's so close to breaking the rule, but they don't quite. And so there is that fine line. And if somebody's worked it out ahead of the rules, oh, I can run down the shore and then jump in, before they say, right, we're going to stick a barrier there, you have to get straight back into the water. You think that's just the competitive part of people saying, how can I gain here? You know, people in triathlons riding right up to the white line, and almost going over, but not quite.
Yeah.
You think, okay, you know.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? But then it's up to the marshals or commissioners, whoever they're there to...
Commissioners?
Yeah.
What's this? Batman?
Yeah. Commissioner Gordon?
Yeah.
He's normally there. Bat phone.
Right, what else have you got?
There's actually been loads of sport, not the predominant sports, like football or tennis or golf on telly.
Tennis isn't a predominant sport.
You wouldn't think so, but it's hugely gross, isn't it, for the LTA. And so good things, you know, like Stockholm.
Yeah.
You watch the triathlon there, and the 70.3 on there as well, wouldn't it?
Mm.
So there's some fantastic television on where... Unfortunate if you're out training, because you would have missed it. But there's plenty of replays on different playback systems like iPlayer, etc., etc. So, yeah, but it's nice to see other sports vying for a for a spot.
Well, that Sunday, you know, there was triathlons on Channel 4 on the Ironman in the, that was in the morning, and then in the afternoon on BBC Two there was Stockholm.
Yeah,
and you kind of think, wow, two triathlons in a day of totally different, you know, one's, you know, the Ironman Corporation, the other is, you know, ITU Olympic-based racing. You think, wow, you know, it's got to a point where you're getting two on in a day. And yes, it's the height of the season, but still, that does show how far, you know, that particular sport has come.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's good to see.
Righty-ho. I was going to go on to listeners' questions.
We should have a jingle for this.
Should we?
Yeah.
Okay. I should have a piece of paper for it somewhere.
Should we get Henry to make one up?
We could do. Yeah. Henry, insert jingle now.
Yeah, now.
No, now. Now. Right. So, what have we got? Oh, yeah. Grant Bateman said, in a two-part tweet, there we go, he said, riding a giant Defy for my standard tries at the moment. Aiming for an Ironman in 2015. Should I be looking to upgrade to a more time trial type bike or to a road bike with good aero, hoping for speed and efficiency but worried about comfort for the 180k? What do you reckon?
You can actually have, you can have all,
you can have it all, you can, you have, can it all. Have it all, yeah. Grant,
you can have it all.
Martin Crocker's just guaranteed you can have it all.
Well, you can. I mean, I suppose from a distance point of view, chatting to the guys that that we know that have done their first Ironman, you know, a few Ironmen, I would say 90% of them have actually gone for a standard road bike, with a set of clip-ons, with maybe the position tweaked for a bit more optimum, slightly better set of wheels and tyres.
Yeah, it depends on also the Ironman they're on, right?
It depends on the course as well, yeah, you know. If it's relatively flat, then, you know, you can more than likely get away with an aero bike. If it's rolling, then, you know, you, 9 times out of 10, you'd be better with a road bike anyway.
And it's like, where's the difference? Because if you're in a triathlon, you should have tri-bars on, okay? Now, be they a super aero, you know, set of tri-bars that are specifically with what I would term, you know, cow horn bars.
Integrated as well, yeah.
And it's all, you know, all super sleek, got bar end shifters. You'd be riding on those, or you'd be riding on a road bike with, you know, drop bars, normal levers, and tri bars that way around.
Yeah.
But with the potential for electronics, you've set up at Southport quite a few people with a road bike that's still got the
electronic shifting
on the front. So, you know, you can have it all. And then if they want to do road racing or sportives, they can pop those bars off, get rid of the front shifting electronics, and they're back to a standard bike.
Robot, yeah.
And the differences in frames, okay, a time trial or, I guess, yeah, but it would be a time trial bike, because a tri bike doesn't really define, it defines a type of geometry rather than an actual, and there's plenty of tri-bikes that aren't aero, and yet really what you're looking for is something that's as aero as possible. But we don't know what this Ironman is, and if you're aiming for an Ironman and it's your first one, you're probably not going to be that, it's probably not a great thing to spend a lot of money trying to be as aero as possible, yeah, if that's going to really stretch your budget and you might not do any more. The benefits are that an aero bike will save you energy, and energy saved over 180k is energy saved. People aren't doing great times on, you know, drop bars. That's what's phenomenal about some of the early triathlons before the tri bars came out, is what they could do, and they were on drop bar bikes. You think, blimey, they weren't even in aero position, or have bar end shifters. They had, you know, downshifters, and they were still able to do good times. So I think you've got to look at what type of courses do you want to be entering. Therefore, do you want something that's, you know, it can be a aero road bike that's still light,
yeah,
and would be great on some of the climbing based courses like, you know, Nice, potentially Lanzarote, or it be a bike that you can then use a lot more in sporties and other things. The more you get specific to a tri bike with bar end shifters, the more it becomes a specific tri bike that isn't going to necessarily be great if you've got a lot of commuting with start stop riding and stuff like that. That's when bar end shifters and a tri bike isn't really that good fun. A road bike with normal STI levers is much easier to use in that scenario. Yeah.
But then you've got a couple of questions that I asked a few guys were, what's the ride profile like? Mm. And they're like, that, what do you mean? I said, well, what's the GPS profile like? There must be a GPS, graph
altitude.
That's there. What's it like? Well, it looks all right.
It's all right, yeah.
The Mona Lisa looks all right, doesn't it? What's it telling you? Is it quite a bit of climbing?
Yeah.
Is there quite a bit of descending? Is it mostly flat? Is it rolling?
Yeah.
That's the
kind
of thing.
That's what you want. A GPS type map my ride type thing,
yeah,
as well as a course profile, because a course profile can tell you ups and downs, but it doesn't tell you how technical those downs might be.
So like Joe was trying to say, your optimum position aero wise is fantastic, but with an aero bike, for instance, with a TT or a time trial bike, a tri bike or a TT bike, they're a bit difficult to climb with. The position is a little bit different to a road bike,
but not unsurmountable. No. You can do it because plenty of people are riding on the Wimbleballs, the Ironman. So you think actually you're always trainable in that position.
Yeah, definitely.
But what's the biggest amount of gain you're going to get? And is it that you don't get the most expensive aero frame, but you do get some good wheels, some great tires, aero helmet, a new tri suit because your old one's bagging, all of that stuff. You've got to look at the drag and the weight of you and the bike. And if it's a really hilly one, perhaps you want something that technically suits your type of descending, because you don't want something with fiddly little tiny aero brakes trying to descend a twisty, turny type of course.
Yeah, definitely. So there's a lot of things to think about before you even get to that stage of going, right, do I need to splash the cash and kind of get myself a new bike, whether it be a tri or TT specific or a new maybe aero road bike.
Do you know the Giant Defy?
Yes. Yeah. So without being rude, a step up from that. I mean, you look at some of the, for instance, the new Giant road bikes, they look nice as well. So personally, I'd be looking at probably course profile of the Ironman that you want to do first grand, and then go, look, realistically, with me spending £3,000-£4,000 having to get a new bike or a new set of wheels, realistically, is it going to help me with this course profile, or is the bike I've got fine? And then maybe half that and go on a new set of wheels. So anywhere between a lighter set, anywhere between £400 and £2,500 more, maybe better spent that way. So,
and the top end stuff is incredibly expensive.
And
it often goes with, not always, but often goes with people that are training at a level where they've done maybe multiple Ironman. So as they've got better, they've invested in better kit. I think it puts pressure on people to have their kind of old bike and then launch a load of money at a brand new Uber bike and think it's going to, somehow plummet their time. It's like, look, you're out there for the first time doing the distance. Look at your budget and think, how can I best get around that course? And there's nothing worse than, somebody that knows that over that year, or he's in fact got, almost 2 years, that they never did get round to, losing that 5 kilograms of body weight, but they, they spent over £5,000 above what they should have, not even £5,000 above what they should have, to get a bike that's going to look great in transition, but they're not going to look great on the run. And I think you have to think about that. The biggest slowing down effect is not your frame, it's not the wheels, it's not all of that, it's how slow you can go in the run if you aren't trained and aren't as light as you can be for race day.
That's what I was going to say. That 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 grand is going to look pretty stupid with you sat by the roadside feeling sick, tired, and you're just propping that bike up against the wall because you can't carry on.
Mm.
So the truth of the matter is the finer points being, is you are fit to race, and if you are fit to race, then all of this kind of falls into a slot.
Because you said, you know, you're hoping for speed and efficiency. Well, I mean, efficiency is about your positioning, okay? Speed is about how much potential power you can put out at about 50 to 55% of your peak power. How much speed you get back is relative to how much power you've got to provide at that point. You can't go even faster and say, well, I'll just work at 65% of peak power, because you won't get through the Ironman without cramping, and you certainly won't get through the run. And then you say, you know, worried about comfort. Well, find, use, and know what saddle's going to work best for you, because that's where most of the pressure is on the bike, and you getting used to the time spent.
It's the time in the saddle.
In the saddle, on the aero bars. Yeah. But is it a course where you're, you know, sometimes you're on the aero bars, and next minute you're going uphill and you're not on the aero bars? Or is it a course, I don't know, Florida, where you're going to be sat on the aero bars a lot of the time?
Yeah.
You've got to think about, you know, well, the comfort issue is what? If it's a comfort issue of 180k on a bike, well, you've got about, you know, 22 months-ish to get used to not going out and every week doing more and more miles and getting used to, you know, I can do 5 hours every week, because it's not going to be a fun next 22 months. You've got to look at the key months for doing those long rides, which if you're UK-based, I'm assuming you are, it's likely to be, you know, from kind of March onwards where you'll do your longest rides. Yeah. And if you don't find comfort, then, you know, look for saddles, look for the, you know, the Ritchie test saddles, look for the physics test saddles,
well, yeah,
and really find out what works for you. And if it doesn't work, don't spend, you know, a massive amount of money on a saddle if it doesn't work. That isn't down to the frame, the wheels, it's down to you and how your body parts suit a saddle. And that's how people get comfy on a bike. And once they're comfy on it, they use that saddle on all their bikes. They swap the saddle onto their other bike. They sit on the same saddle, whatever bike they're riding. And they really get used to that saddle. So there's no reason for you not to get, certainly, as much speed and efficiency as possible based on you being set up efficiently on the bike. And the comfort is down to you getting used to it.
Yeah. So hopefully, Grant, that'll clear the waters for you. But the biggest issue I think you'll have is one, when you've made a selection, is make sure you are ready and you're able to ride that 180k, rather than spend a shed load of money and go, well, what a waste of time that was, feeling dejected, and then, you know, not wanting to do another Ironman again. So
for all cat lovers, Mr. Bojangles has just walked in the office. Bojangles. So if you hear him in the background, he just wants to say hello. I did a tweet, and I'll use it as a point of admin at this time of year. But I said,
is it controversial, Joseph?
No, I don't think so. No, but there was a follow up which I wanted. Somebody followed up with a blah blah blah, and I just wanted to define it. Okay, so I said Chris Froome finished in 0.08%.
Ah, you've opened a can of worms now,
what?
Joseph. Okay. I did see this.
0.8% less than second place in Le Tour 2013. So he only needed 0.001% for every hour of racing. Marginal gains. Okay. And then I got a tweet back from Warren Mason, and he said, Chris won the Tour de France by 4:20. He took 4:39 off Quintana over 87 minutes of the second individual time trial stages, equivalent to 5.3%. Definitely not marginal. No, I absolutely agree. It wasn't marginal. Chris Froome is probably in the top handful of time trialists, you know, on the planet. You know, okay, you might get, you know, your Cancellaras and the obviously the Tony Martins
well,
and a couple of others on a good day that would be there. So certainly over that particular part, he did clearly have more than a marginal gain, and that is where the gains of, you know, looking at what kit Quintana was on, which I don't know, versus Chris Froome's kit, maybe he was just making the most out of it to get as much as possible out of that individual time trial. But also, if he finished 4:20 ahead, but he took 4:39 off of Quintana, then somewhere he also lost time. So he didn't always make a marginal gain every single stage against Quintana. But over the whole race, which is how it is categorised, not over the individual time trial, but over the whole race, he could have, you know, he could have taken four, you know, 4:39 off of him, and the next day lost 14:39, of which that wouldn't have been a very good marginal gain the day before, to lose it all the next day by 10 minutes. So still, marginal gains must still add up, that when you lose things, you're still gaining. At the end of it. Because he must have, you know, he must have lost time on other days. You know, they sometimes do these graphics where you see how people won and lost time against their nearest competitor. And sometimes, clearly, Quintana must have got some time over Chris, because there's 19 seconds there straight away that he must have lost against him. And at other parts, he only needed to cover what Quintana did, because he was already far enough ahead at that point to say, "It's okay, I don't need to do any more." So the point I was making was that if you break it down over the whole race, which is how the Tour is measured, he actually did make very marginal gains. But some way he made losses. You know, he did blow up.
Yeah.
Had he not had that gel or two given to him, who knows how much he must have lost, you know? He certainly was not doing very well, and was you know, when people said, "Wow, it was amazing that Richie Port went back to the car and got up to him so quickly." Yeah, but he that's because Richie Port hadn't bonked and Chris Froome had. And so, you know, his marginal losses there were, well, we know next time how to do that. You know, don't blame the car. Have enough food to be able to think, or, you know, swap some food before you bonk and get it down your throat. Because you can't tell me somebody can't swap something to somebody and it not be seen.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. You can give people food. It's taking it from the car that was the issue.
That's right.
Normally
within 10K or
It depends on the climb, and it depends on there are some exceptional circumstances where they are allowed to. But yeah, overall, I get the gist that in a particular ride that was 5%, but then he lost at other points. And I think it was very controversial about the gel, because I think that was a game changer. And it was breaking, I know they kind of, you know, brushed over it a bit. That broke the rules.
Yeah.
And it broke the rules to the extent that it was very poorly penalised. I mean, somebody else could break the rules and get a real slaughter in. And you can't, and it's one of those things where they knew they'd done it. And to some degree, it was kind of almost as if, you know, well, yeah, but it's just getting back. It was no different to somebody else doing something where they gained, because they gained an advantage by it.
Yeah.
And the marginal losses weren't marginal at that point. He was losing time like mad.
But then, if it hadn't actually been caught on TV, if it was a guy back at the in the gruppetto kind of at the back, you know, taking gels on afterwards, would anybody really care?
But this made the difference to the Tour.
It shouldn't matter. A rule's a rule, isn't it? Regardless.
Yeah. But the most important part is to notice the ones where the prize money, the accolades, and also where people are watching. Because if people are watching, it doesn't send out a very good signal. You know, for all the moral high grounds that they've set.
Someone should have drove up alongside, and the race referee just whipped it out of his mouth, threw it on the floor, and went, "No, carry on."
No. Or he could do the research. Say, "It's all right, I just swirled it and spat it out."
Yeah, that's it, yeah. For 15 gels, utter waste.
Utter waste, yeah. Yes.
But you are right there, yeah. For your marginal gains.
Marginal gains, yeah. Yes. And I think it is about the little bits, and it is amazing how they stack up. And I know sometimes marginal gains, people forget that there are still losses. You know, for every gain you think you're making this coming winter, there's losses happening. Could be age, could be...
Oh, what did you look at me like that then, when you said age?
Well, I just...
I'm
pre-warning you. I'm just making sure you're aware of the slippery slope that you're just about to...
Patent baldness. That's what you were looking at me, weren't you?
No. The slippery slope you're just about to jump on. But there are, you know, assumptions by some people that if they do get, you know, a new bit of kit, or they find a new drink that's going to give them, you know, amazing speed, that somehow it's all going to add up to exactly where they were before. And what you realise is there's always things that are chipping away: detraining, gaining in body fat, loss of muscle, loss of time to recover due to work, family, big stressors, things like that, that, you know, don't only look at your marginal gains and think they're all going to be making you quicker and quicker, and therefore extrapolate things too far and go, "Crikey, look how fast I'm going to be next year." consider that there are marginal losses happening, okay, and that sometimes all the marginal gains you can gain over the winter will just about make up for all the losses. And so to get back to where you were is a great thing. Year on year, to keep doing what you're doing, certainly as people get older,
yeah,
or as they as their life gets more complicated, or as they try to hold on to very good performances. I mean, it's easy if you're early into a sport, or not early into a sport, yeah, early into a sport, or you're quite new to a sport. Oh, great. The gains come thick and fast. It's every, you know, every few weeks you can say, oh, wow, I've improved. And then you hit the glass ceiling and you're trying to bash that whole ceiling upwards, and then it gets hard. So when PBs start getting harder and harder, just to get back to them next year is going to take a lot of work. And that's what people forget. And they start the season and go, oh, not as fast as I was last year. Yeah, but where did you start last year? Oh, yeah, look at my times. Look at the races I did early on. Look at my, I don't know, triathlon experience, my sportives, my half marathons. And actually, don't always measure yourself by the highest point, because that's always going to be the highest point.
Yeah.
It's everything else. You know, where were you? Where were you in, you know, February? And some people realise that, you know, they came a long way from February to the season. Oh, wow, God, I lost 5 kilograms, and wow, I'm much quicker. Okay, you did it last year. That doesn't mean you can put it all back on and start again, but it does mean that some people's gains are going to be easily met, and maybe they might go a bit quicker, or it's going to be really hard. And at the pro level, everybody's nudging every possible recovery method and supplement and technology, and so some of the decisions that they make, like some of the TT bike choices that they made, were just unbelievable.
Yeah.
Because you think even an amateur with an ounce of nous would go, no, that's not the right bike to do. That's not even close to aero, and yet they did it, and they are absolute professionals. And I think what Sky do is make 98% of things right. And therefore they get the gains. And it's difficult for amateurs to do that, because you can't be worrying or researching everything under the sun, because don't miss the fact you just got to get your training done first. That's and foremost. It. That'll make a big difference. If you've got the time and the money, then you can start to nitpick at things or think, blimey, I've missed out on that. And it does work. Next time I'll do that. I'll stand on the scales once a week from January the 1st, and I will get down to the weight I need to. But this year, oh yeah, I never really did it. You know, there are some easy gains, there's some hard gains, but meanwhile, in the background, there will be some losses. We're not all going to be here, you know, in, let's say, 7 months' time. 7 months' time? 8 months' time? Going, blimey, I'm even faster than I was a year before, and everything's great, and I've not even gone one step backwards. Come on, then.
No, I like it.
Do you?
I like it, yeah.
Oh, what, you're going to be not going one step backwards?
Well, I don't know.
You're going to go sideways?
Well, yeah, maybe, yeah. More of a slide sideways, yeah. But again, back to that, I think you should, regardless of professional sport, you know, those guys are literally just, you know, picking out little bits where they think they can gain.
Yeah.
And what I think was good by the organisers, for instance, with the Tour de France, is they had to put that element of equipment doubt in someone's mind, which made the teams think, we're going to have to do something here. And you can guarantee that people like Sky and people like, you know, Saxo Tinkoff and Garmin have gone and ridden that and gone, what do you reckon, boys? You know, what's the take on it? Do you think it's TT bikes switching over to road bikes or what? But for,
and they've probably run little simulations.
Yeah,
and,
of course they would have.
And look at wind directions and stuff and worked out what is the difference. And others didn't even look like they were going to change anything.
That's it. But at least I think with a lot of guys that are training, especially for your multi-sport or your multi-discipline sport, you should have your base numbers. Mm. You should know your base numbers, regardless of whether that's a weight, an average speed even, you know, heart rate. You know, if you're lucky, then a power meter. You should have your base numbers, and you should know roughly where you came in on that year and go, well, I am 20 watts, you know, above what I came in last year. Mm. You know, my weight's pretty good. And, you know, doesn't automatically mean you're going to be flying, but you should always have a marker that you can go back to and go, oh, right, that's what I did. Mm. You know, something substantial, but something that you can look at and go, oh, yeah, I see what I did there. You know, because doing the same year on year, and with no gains, something's got to be wrong.
But gains sometimes...
Well, how do you measure a gain?
Gains, yeah. What you don't want to do is see that a fast course, a short course, or an exceptional set of circumstances that, you know, came together on that particular day represent anything but exceptional.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If you take a very, very good... triathlon course that, you know, maybe things are a bit short or they're exceptionally flat, but they give you really good times, that is going to give you a good end result. So don't think that's your norm.
That's right.
That's
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And on another course, bit long, really bad weather conditions, maybe that's more of a reality, that that's what you're going to be. Oh, yeah, I'm going to do a 1:15 sprint. As opposed to the 58-minute one, where
that's
a
right,
lot of
yeah.
it was short,
yeah.
you know, and you just go, yeah, you've got to be able to look
you've got
to
be at
able
your to pick the bones out of it, haven't you?
Yeah,
really?
But be yeah. realistic that, and people that quote short courses as their PBs are putting themselves in a situation where they can't actually do what their numbers suggest.
Yeah, yeah.
But it does also mean that they're kind of in the back of their mind, they either don't realise it's a short course and somebody's got to tell them, or they are convincing themselves that the short course bit didn't really make any difference. If it is short, if Usain Bolt ran 90 metres, yes, he would blow away 9 seconds quite easily.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't say, oh, wow, he's just done 100 metres in under 9 seconds. No, we go, it's short. And many, many sportives running races, they're not the right distances.
Yeah.
You know, some are, and they're 3A's measured, or they're, you know, GPS certified, that people have done them multiple times. But the ones that are short, sometimes people sort of forget or you know, kind of just ignore it. And I think that's bad, because that makes out that all that you've done has come to fruition and you are actually as good as you think you
yeah.
are.
Yeah.
The good thing about the time trial in the Tour was that because it was a hilly one, you didn't just have, we can pick the people who's going to win.
That's right.
Straight
yeah,
away.
Yeah.
There were people that were good at climbing at speed that actually got up closer than if it was a flat, fast one like the team time trial had been. And I think it was good because it brought in that equipment. It brought in the idea of, wow, actually, how quick the mechanic can get out of a car and chuck a bike off the top now becomes part of the marginal gains.
Yeah, like a Formula One pit
yeah,
stop,
yeah.
really.
You can imagine yeah. some of the, you know, you can imagine them kind of driving around a car park, getting the guy to jump out and get the bike off, and, you know, kind of
but
doing
could you,
it.
Could you imagine the pressure as well?
I know.
Because the rider's literally got to get off, put his bike to the side, stand there, while the mechanic's faffing around with the roof rack, trying to get the bike
out. And they're looking
out.
At quick releases
yeah.
on the roof rack and
oh,
stuff. You know. And one, did you see one team, the guy was actually hanging out, so that the moment it stopped, he unclipped it, then
yeah.
jumped out, and I thought it was brilliant. Brilliant.
But that's what I mean, that's the good thing about prior planning with
yeah,
everything
yeah, yeah, yeah.
as well.
But
yeah.
they had looked at it and thought, how can we make the best of this? And it didn't just all sit in the car and they go, oh, we've got to get out quickly. They'd actually thought about it. And it wasn't against the rules.
Yeah.
They had this special sort of speed adapter to get the bike off quickly. And then they did push them a fair while as well. And he thought, actually, that's not breaking the rules. Nobody said you couldn't push the rider or you had to be in the car seated with your seatbelt done up at
that's
the point.
Right.
You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
They weren't all this. But somebody will come up with another rule to say, you can't do this, you can't do that. I've got something interesting for you now.
Go on, Joseph. You
okay.
just pointed at me with
well,
this dagger-like finger.
I flashed the... the office coffee in front of your nose, because I've got some research which I think you'll be interested in, because it's on caffeine compared to coffee.
Right, so yes,
so,
okay. Yeah,
yeah, so instead of taking, you know, caffeine like, you know, your classic like Pro Plus type stuff that people would take.
Yeah.
Or
caffeinated gel or something.
Caffeinated
like that.
Gel or like Power by Charger, it's got caffeine in it. There's a few drinks with caffeine, gels, but that's it. That's your kind of, you know, your choices. Whereas coffee, lots of people have it, but wonder, oh, is a cup of coffee going to do anything? They looked at it. They got...
who's they, Joseph?
Who's
they?
They are a group that are based up in Birmingham. And also one of the people is based in America. It is a freely accessible piece of research out there. It is entitled, for those that are on Google and want to tap the title in to find it, the author is Hodgson, which is Hodgson, and it's A. Hodgson, and it's the metabolic and performance effects of caffeine compared to coffee during endurance exercise.
Please spell it right.
anyway, they looked at, you know, fairly fit riders, 58 millilitres VO2 max, so certainly solid. Not going to, you know, not going to win the World Championships, but solid. And they cycled at a steady state, and then they did a time trial effort. So they did 45 minutes, 30 minutes steady state, and then did a 45-minute time trial. So the time trial wasn't 45 minutes. It was roughly the energy consumption of a 45-minute effort.
Time, yeah.
So if you went harder, you'd get that energy out of the system quicker. So they looked at it. They gave them either caffeine or coffee or placebo or decaf. So the decaf is the perfect placebo because the placebo otherwise would be water. But if you've got decaf, you think you're getting coffee. So, I've had the coffee charge, I'll still go for it. The results were, okay, average power over this particular effort, when they had caffeine or coffee, was 294 and 291 watts, which is bang on the same, okay? When they had either the placebo or decaf, it dropped to 276 to 277. So we have a drop there, a very roughly sort of 14 to 18 watts, which is, you know, enough.
Yeah, definitely. Enough.
You know, 20 watts is a good upgrade of aero wheels or aero helmet. And this is, you know, this is your coffee versus just having a sip of water. It was taken an hour before, so it's the classic. Recommended take it an hour before and then use it, but the coffee was effective, but a lot of people will find it quite amazing that it was weighed and it was 11 grams of coffee. Okay,
right.
If you weigh out on scales how much coffee 11 grams is, it is a lot.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. Because they use Nescafe and it provides 3 grams of caffeine per 100 grams, okay, and they obviously wanted around 300 milligrams, so they had to get 11 grams of it. It was dissolved in 600 mils of hot water, so you know, big mug of coffee
of mud. Sweet Lord!
But they did analyse the coffee to check that there was that amount of caffeine in there. So it did, you know, pass the test that it was, you know, it was the right amount. So it wasn't that thing of, you know, when people say, should I use coffee? And up to now, I've sort of said, yeah, but I don't know how much you're going to get. Well, Nescafe is a standard product, and they tested it and it comes out 11 grams or 11.8, so bang on 12 grams. So if you've got, you know, very accurate digital kitchen scales, you can do it out. And I can't, one particular client with very accurate scales did it, and it was something like, I think off the top of my head, it was something like 6 teaspoonfuls or something like that. I mean, it was a lot. It wasn't just, oh yeah, I put quite a big teaspoonful of coffee in. 11 grams is a lot of coffee.
But then saying that, I think if you can, I know people like their coffee, but if you can kind of stomach your gels, you have got a measured amount in there. It's not guesswork, is it? So, you know, you're kind of, you're almost better off just saying, well, I'll take a gel. I don't like the taste of them, but I know there's 35 milligrams in there, with a measured amount, with a bit of carbohydrate. So, I think sometimes instead of putting yourself under a bit of pressure, going, well, I don't know whether I've had enough caffeine or if I had any at all, you know, measure it out or just grab a gel and, you're not experimenting because you know how much is in it.
Yeah, so. I can't remember. I know when the person sent me the email, the number of teaspoonfuls I did think, wow, that's not even like, oh yeah, I put two in there and that's quite strong, you know.
This
was, it was something like 4 to 6. I mean, it was enough for me to think, wow, I think I'd rather, hence why I think it was in 600 mils of water.
Yeah, well, you'd have to.
You'd have to. I mean, yeah. You couldn't put that in a normal like 300 mil cup and it'd blow your head off. It'd be so like, yeah. Plus, I think you'd have to, if you wanted to do it, okay, it's probably quite cheap to do it, because even if it's 6 or 8 teaspoonfuls, that's not that much money-wise coffee. 11 grams of coffee, You look at how much coffee is, you know, per kilo or something like that. It's still going to be relatively low. But yeah, you've got gels, you've got the pre-race drinks that are out there that have got caffeine in there. And a standardised dose is what you're looking for. That's why when somebody says, oh, I got this special brew. Yeah, but the problem is you don't know
what's
how much
in it.
It is.
Yeah, yeah.
And this showed that, blimey, you need a lot of caffeine in normal sources to actually get an effect. And I think that, I guess the way to look at it is, if you are a responder to caffeine, know what works correctly and that can be duplicated. Because what you don't want to be doing is, you know, one week having a, you know, an energy drink with it in, the next week having a gel, the next week having something different, and then finding that you're not quite sure what suits you. And sometimes it's a bit bubbly with the carbonated drink, and other times, the gel's a bit sickly, I need some drink with it. So by all means, experiment with things, but not in key events, and maybe in just quality sessions. You know, an hour before quality session, think, right, what if this was a race come up, let's try it. And that's certainly how I found the best way for me to do it, when you don't always want to experiment in races. And you kind of think, yeah, maybe I just, you know, I'll try the coffee, but maybe I don't. Maybe I try a gel. Maybe I try a pre-race like charger. But try it, see whether it works, but don't think it's a small amount.
No.
Even the Pro Plus you're looking at, for most people, between 4 and 6 Pro Plus, which is a lot. It is a lot. But that's the ergogenic level. That's what you're, that's what you're looking at. I was just trying to see what they actually had in terms of what the caffeine was. It was anhydrous caffeine. So by the looks of it, it's pretty much bang on what Pro Plus is. It was provided by a company in the UK, but that's what Pro Plus is, anhydrous caffeine.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
So there you go, caffeine. Caffeine works to the extent of, at the biggest stretch, 18 watts, that's a sizable chunk.
There you go. For something, for instance, like a gel or a cup of coffee that could cost £2.
Probably not even that.
Well, the gels start about one.
Oh yeah, so yeah, gel, like, yeah, yeah, yeah. A cup of coffee, but when you looked at it in terms of price, blimey, for £4, you can get a massive jar of it. So I would imagine that, you know, each one, but I can't imagine drinking 600 milliliters of coffee.
Yeah,
that's the other side of it. You kind of think, yeah, that's certainly a lot of drink.
That's a lot of drink. But so that's very interesting.
Tell us your experiences on drinking 600 mils of coffee
yeah.
With eight spoonfuls, and I'm not sure it is 8 spoonfuls, but we will see. But yeah, that paper is out there. It's open access, so it's freely available. What else do you know?
What else have I got to?
Are you having an end of season surge?
In what way? So
only there's an issue 220 of out now with those two very attractive male models on their bikes.
They are highly attractive.
For those that are out there, look on page 36 and 37 of your 220 this month. These are Devon men.
Don't expect to see me and Joe. We've just said two highly attractive young men.
Yeah. No, I just wonder whether you were doing anything at the end of the season, or you just...
That's it now for me. I'm done. Thank you. Thank you for your inquiry. Christmas? When's Christmas? Yeah. But no, I should literally been riding my bike for sheer pleasure now.
And good on you. Because I think there is a point where, you know, we are in September. This is a different... I notice it coaching people. You must notice it in people with what face and head and attitude they have when they are talking to you on the phone or buying stuff. You know, pre-season and early season, it's a lot about it's really important and it's really this and this, and as time goes on, you know, they hit their goals or they don't hit their goals, or they realize that, you know, it's one of those years and it might not go right, or it all went right, and their attitude changed. Now people are a bit more, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, it's the end of season. Not everyone, but quite a few people have done their A races, and there is a mental shift. And at some point, that what you just said is absolutely essential, is just to go, I'm just chilling. I can still be training. I can have fun. I can still, you know, have a bit of a ding dong with somebody that you know, be it your buddy or, you know, the latest Strava hotshot Uber climbing, you know, expert that's out there that you wants to race you. But you can have fun, because we are way off the big W word happening, and yet lots of people have said, wow, I'm really fit at the moment. It's like, yeah, use it, go out there and have fun, but yeah, don't think you have to go, oh, I suppose I just got to go off and plod around. No, go out there, experiment, try group rides and try and race yourself, but don't think that you have to.
Yeah,
the pressure's off to do whatever you want.
Well, that's the good thing, because the weather's been so nice.
Yeah,
you found that people have done so many more miles. So they've either come to September and gone, I am absolutely shattered. You know, I've been
shattered even.
Yeah, you know, or you've had guys that have gone, look, I've had a fantastic summer. You know, I'm going to prolong my race season a little bit longer because, you know, I'm still in pretty good nick. I still feel fit and healthy. So, all right, it's not going to be my best race, but I've been dying to do it for a couple of years. It hasn't fallen into the training schedule, but I'm just gonna go with it. So that's the good thing, is I think a lot of the time people look at the pool, look at the bike, and then kind of look at your running shoes, and then go and do their laps or their circuits or their rides that they do, or the pool distance they've got to do, and don't stop occasionally and go, I might actually getting into the sea, just going into the sea and having a little bit of a swim.
Rather than a bike.
It becomes, it's just not very good for the bike. But yeah, just getting into the water, open water, and going, oh, I'm just going to have a swim. Stop, have a little bob around. Maybe a few, especially for us down here, you can have a natter with the surface. They won't be very happy, but there you go. And the thing with the bike as well, you go, oh, I can't remember the last time I rode, you know, this lane, that lane. Funny enough, I did something which the other day I thought was, well, not peculiar, but I rode round where I used to live. And you know, all the little lanes that you know, and I'm talking when I was, you know, seven years old. So you kind of rode around the little roads that, and I was just thinking, God, that's not changed. There's my old house, and I know it's peculiar, but you just, and then rode off and hooked up with another little loop that I used to do when I first started riding. And
I've thought about doing that, going back to where I was brought up and do it, and just think, wow, that'd be quite good to do it.
But the only thing that I didn't really think about is it's nice to do it with another person, so you can go, that's where I grew up there, and this is where we used
to. They get bored after.
I know, I can
imagine. To be honest, they get bored.
Can you imagine them just kicking the tyres again? It's very interesting. When do we ride, then? When do we ride? But and it's the same with running. You do these loops that you time yourself on, you know, maybe as a bit of threshold work, instead of slowing down and having a good old look around and thinking, oh, I don't know where that lane goes, if it's an off-road run, for instance.
Which is what I did with a couple of people, I won't mention their names, they've got enough fame and fortune as it is.
Yeah.
And just sort of did a bit of a random few bits of rides that some were totally random, but kind of just experimented a bit. And I think that's what you want, you know, when you haven't got exact, you know, zone one or power numbers or intervals or distance reps running, whatever, just vary it up a bit. And sometimes you find, actually, that's quite a good thing to do, or I like that session, I'm gonna write that down, and next time I go to the pool, do it. A little bit of experimentation is quite good, because it can mean you go off and you visit, you know, one particular route. I don't think I've ridden it this year at all, and yet used to ride it fairly regularly. Just kind of, some routes work for certain things, but to do it in a random way gives you a sense of, it's kind of that kid-like enjoyment of just doing it. Otherwise, you can pretty much, I can look down, know where I am, and know what, you know, the watts or the heart rate or the speed to be doing, because you've done it enough times to know, right, this is where. Not because I don't think I train intensely. I enjoy what I do, but I certainly am not out there scowling and
riding.
You know, actually, it's about, look, if it's intervals, I'll probably be in my garage, so you won't be able to see me anyway. But if it's running off the bike, it may well be, you know, off somewhere completely different. But it's that niceness of doing something a bit different, because I think that you can and should, for your key goals, have to do measurable things, and sometimes have to do things that are your bread and butter sessions. But then this, for most people, is the fun part, or is about to be the fun part of the year, where they can actually go, oh yeah, I'm really fit. I can kind of have a little bit of, you know, just go off and experiment and doing different courses and showing other people your courses, but also somebody else saying, oh, you've never been this way. No, I've never been that way. Right, let's try it. Or I've never been with that group. I'm going to go and try a session with them, see what they do. That'll give me an idea of whether that session's going to work for me.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, the thing is I keep saying it, is you do this sport because you enjoy it. You know, the addictive part of it is the fact that you do some hard training and then you see the results. You know, that's the addictive part to it. But now, is, you know, if your A races are done, you know, have a look at a couple of races. I wonder what that's like. I used to ride around there, so I'll do it as a as a race. Or, well, you know, I'm a little bit bored with maybe the swimming or the bike or the run part, and you want to do something different, then go and do something different. So, but yeah, that's pretty much what it is. I mean, like I said, my season's finished quite early, and I've never had this amount of time, you know, kind of not racing.
So, but it doesn't mean you're not fit, and it doesn't mean you're not actually adding in stuff. Sometimes you might just be adding in time to sort of recharge and think about what it is you want to do.
Yeah, that's it.
Because it's different when you've done it multiple years compared to somebody that's coming towards the end of, say, their first year of road racing or tri or something like that. And, God, they're full of enthusiasm. And actually, it's kind of getting them to October to go, right, let's ease back a bit now. Let's see
what I want to go again.
Yeah, let's see what we're going to learn about, what things you've got to accept are going to happen in the coming months because of the annual cycle and so on. Whereas when you've done that, you almost know what's around the corner. You almost know you're going to be getting back to the grindstone, but you want to kind of keep it fresh. And the weather has been good. We've seen, you know, a lot of I think very nice weather, certainly to do training in. Some exceptionally hot stuff that hasn't necessarily been the, you know, the best of fun. But it has meant that we've had a summer, and lots of people have been able to race and been able to, you know, kind of do the training and the race, and not just, oh, well, I did the race, but it was the, you know, it was only because I paid for it, otherwise I didn't get out the front door, it was horrendous all week. This year has been the opposite. People have done lots, and if you get to this point and you feel like, wow, I'm pretty frazzled, I don't know how much more I want to do, well, just do whatever feels right, because eventually you'll get out the door, you do a bit of exercise, and then think, yeah, that's about right, but don't have a big plan, just do it for fun.
Yeah, definitely.
That coefficient rolling resistance stuff. Come on, some tyre stuff. What did it? What did it teach you then? The sort of brands that you sell are up there. The ones you would imagine.
Yeah, there's a couple of them that which I was surprised by. So, for instance, the what I've got is a chart effectively that rates the power for a pair of tyres. So it gives me the name of the tyre, the type of tyre in the brand, and the size of the tyre as well. So this is all done at 40 kph. So it looks as though, well, believe it or not, the Vittoria Evo Open Course has come out. These are the 22Cs, and the Evo Open Course Slick, the 23Cs, come out on top. They managed to produce 29 watts at 40 kph. So are we calling that drag?
No, that's the required.
Would you say
no, that's the required amount of energy to move the person
needed
and the bike.
Right,
so the lower the figure the better, because it's less effort for them to move. And it is from a source called
bike blather
blogspot.co.ca
dogspot.ca
which bike blather, you know, some data which there's various people out there. There's another one, Al Morrison, that does testing, and bit by bit they're all starting to get certain tires and brands and models within each range nearer to a consensus as to what's good, bad, or indifferent. And I think it's the same, you know, it's the same sort of, it's the usual suspects, I'd call it, you know, the Open Course of Vittorias, the Conti GP4000s and TTs, you know, some of the Challenge range as well are really good. And, you know, when you're talking about something being 10 or even, you know, approaching 20 watts difference in tyres, lots of times people assume that, you know, some of those brands that are worse, actually, you know, they still say in much of the advertising of a lot of brands, you know, they always say, oh, it's low rolling resistance. And they just sort of claim it. And people just say it quite often in ads. It's just one of those things, you know, low rolling resistance. And yet, often when you look at the numbers, many of the tyres they say are not. I mean, it might be low rolling resistance compared to the worst possible tyre on the planet, but they're not low rolling resistance. Low is those few very good, you know, quite not exceptionally expensive tires by any means.
No.
And you know, you've got within that data, there's a certain amount of tubs, but there's quite a lot of clinchers. And most people will probably be clincher based if they're triathletes. There are some triathletes that ride on tubs, but a lot ride on clinchers. It's just, you know, cycling is one of their sports. They're not necessarily ultra au fait with tubs and gluing. And for many people, getting a clincher on which stays round can be changed easily in a race, can be changed for specific races without having to re-glue everything. It makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
A lot more sense.
And I mean, another thing as well, which is tyre companies are now beginning to develop and spend more money on our tubeless,
yes,
clincher tyres.
Yeah.
So not tubulars.
No, tubeless.
So tubeless. So basically all it is using the same clincher tyre that you get to take you take off with a tyre lever, put the inner tube in, but without the inner tube. So they're trying to work on the carcass of the tyre, yeah, being slightly more supple. And yeah, what would be interesting is the first kind of editions of these. They have been out for
What's the advantage of a tubeless?
I don't know. See, this is what I'm trying to... Mm. I mean, obviously, they are a little bit lighter, you know, because you haven't got... But then, to make them more puncture-proof, you have to thicken up the carcass of the tyre, which means then it doesn't deform as well as some of the other tyres that we have, yeah, that take in.
Because obviously car tyres are tubeless.
Yeah.
And many of the, you know, mountain bikers are going to tubeless, aren't they?
Most of the guys are running, yeah, tubeless anyway.
So you think, so there must be certain advantages in certain scenarios.
But there is, you know, the early renditions of these tubeless tyres just weren't any good because you only needed to ping something like a small stone or, yeah, you know, a pothole, and then that's it, the tyre's done.
Yeah, because you've only got one layer, at least with a inner tube, you've got to go through the tyre and penetrate the inner tube,
yeah,
as well.
But also is the amount of friction that a tube generates inside of a clincher tyre, yeah, when it's rolling on. But, you know, I'd be interested to see the comparisons now with new technology, like, for instance, I know Schwalbe are coming out with some tubeless tyres.
Right.
Now, they are mega expensive, but I'd like to know.
But that's the early
technology is going to be like that, isn't it?
Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'd love to know what their kind of their rolling resistances are, you know, compared to clinchers at the minute, because I know a couple of teams that were trying to run these tubeless tyres in the Tour.
Oh, right.
But then started to go back to the more conventional kind of tyre and inner tube,
yeah,
or tubular. Mm. So a lot of the teams run tubular. But the problem you get with a tubeless tyre is if it does lose pressure slowly, you don't notice it until you're coming into a corner, and then all of a sudden you can burp a tyre, what we call burp. So if you hit a square-edged object, the bead pops off of the rim and just lets a little bit of air out quickly, then shuts itself off. But you will have a fluid in there that kind of seals these little gaps up. But it would be interesting to see what they roll up against are these standard
but tires. The reason why you have tubeless on a mountain bike is to reduce pinches, which is less of an issue on the road anyway.
But the problem you still get with the tubeless tires off-road is the fact you can run them at lower pressures, but they still burp, they still rub, but they deform better.
Burp. Look,
yeah,
at that. You've learned a whole new vocabulary today with Martin. Actually, we always learn a whole new vocabulary every day with Martin, believe me.
Make most of it up. No, but yeah, with these tyres, you can run them at slightly lower pressures with the off-road tyres,
yeah,
which means the ride is smoother, but you get better grip, cornering as well, like I said. You still run the risk of giving a burp.
It's worth for those that are sportive riders, road racers, time trialists, anything where you ride a bike, to actually play, you know, it's one of the things to play around with, I think, this time of year, is actually the pressure. You'd be surprised how high a pressure 90 psi is.
Yeah.
You put 90 psi in and ride it, and you think, well, actually, that's quite firm, and it will feel a bit softer. Certainly when you get up to the, you know, the 110s and upwards, it feels quite firm and it's a nice ride. And when you really want to roll on a good surface at speed, then, you know, certainly for somebody with a, you know, 80 to 85 kilogram rider plus bike scenario, get up to 120, 125 and it really starts to roll.
Yeah.
But 90 is amazing. How I think when people think when they pump it up, go, oh, that's quite hard, and they think it must be 120, and then you put the pump on, and it shows 90, you think, blimey, pump it up to 120, 125, assuming that you haven't got clinchers that will blow off at 125, and check that. You need to check what your rims will take. I'm talking tubs at the moment. It's amazing how much difference that extra pressure takes to get into the tire and how hard it then feels. And I think if you play around training on 100 PSI, it feels firm, but it rides beautifully.
I mean, one of the guys at the shop was doing some riding and chatting to one of the ex-Cervelo test riders on the test team. And he was saying that a lot of the guys on these on the classics, like the spring classics, were running their tubs at about 95 PSI. Number one, if it's a bit greasy, they just deform a little bit just to give you a bit more grip. But it's just the comfort factor as well. So, you know, if they're on kind of some of these roads that are more like country roads, these classics, you know, he said if you do come across gravel or potholes or a bumpy section, you know, they're not so bone jarring that know you're worried that you're gonna lose your teeth.
But Vittoria have got a good app. It is on the iPhone. It was working when I last tried it. No, because it went funny for a while and then it updated and it went okay. But you know, you put in your weight, put in the conditions and stuff. It's amazing how some people just routinely just got this number in their mind. Unfortunately, some of them it's 140 and they think they should be riding 140. It's like, no. For, you know, it depends on your weight, so I can't give a number. But it's very, very, very uncommon for somebody to need more than 125 PSI.
Yeah.
You've got to be a big rider to need that and be on very nice surfaces.
I was going to say, riding on glass, pretty much.
So, you know, you've got to know what it is. If you don't know how many PSI are in your tires and you're doing triathlons, don't just sort of say, oh, I don't really know. You should have a track pump. You should know, you know, how much goes in there. If you're a triathlete or somebody that goes to sportifs and has their bike in the back of the car, then you should have the track pump in there and adjust it to the conditions, adjust it to what you feel is about right, and ask people, you know, not just the local know it, but a few people about what sort of PSI you think you should have in your tyres based on the width of the tyre, the conditions, the weight of you and the bike, etc. But it's surprising that some people just have this default number.
That's right.
If they're going off training, they put in 120. If they're racing, they put in 120. If it's wet and bumpy, they put in 120. It's like, no, you know, motorbikes, MotoGP. Formula One, they spend thousands of pounds trying to get pressures and temperatures of tyres bang on. And they're not on a tiny little thing. They're on a massive blueprint of tyre. So you should know your tyre pressure.
It's funny what a difference tyre pressure makes. Again, I know a gent who works for one of the CRT teams for MotoGP. When he first started with the team, went to put the wheel on the bike. And they said, well, what PSI is in it? No, I don't know, about 100 odd PSI, and they were like, that what about? He said, no, this is the tire pressure it needs to be, and it could be like, you know, I didn't know the exact, but it was like 87 PSI, that's what it has to be before it's warmed up, because we know what the temperature goes up to, you know, what the PSI goes up to. So those guys are looking at, you know, point, you know, one of a PSI or one PSI is going to make the difference. But I mean, I'm the same though. I've got a default PSI which is 100 on my clinchers. And I just put it in, that's it.
Yeah.
But
100 is reasonable for most training. And if you wanted to ride on most conditions, that'd be okay. It would be a bit slower on very good tyres on smooth surfaces. If you feel a little bit stodgy, but not much. It's amazing how 100 is quite firm. You put 100 in and ask people to check it, I bet they say, gosh, that's about 120, isn't it? It's amazing how much that is. And remember, there's two wheels. So your body weight is split between the two. So actually, you know, 100 pounds per square inch, there's, you know, you've only got to get your tyres wet, put it on concrete or something like that, sit on the bike full weight and look at the size that you're on. You're probably on, like, you know, a square inch front and back. Yeah. So you've got your weight split between two and split between 2 centimetres squared. So it's amazing that 100 PSI, which is 50 kilograms per wheel, is actually quite a lot.
Yeah.
I know that it's not always uniform. If you hit something, it wants to be able to take a bit more than your body weight, because your body weight hitting something is more than 100 PSI.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how strong that feels when you press a tyre at 100. And if you've ever had one go down, you think, "Cool, that's really low." And you put the pressure gauge on your track pump, and it still shows, like, I don't know, you think it's really low, and it shows something like 60. You pump it for a while and it hits 85. Think, blimey, 85 is quite hard.
Yeah.
So default of 100 is not that. It's when people's default is 125.
Yeah, I know. Well, we used to get guys in just saying, "Oh, you know, I'm looking for like a soft riding carbon bike. So I've got an aluminium one, but you know, it just rattles, you know, rattles me to death." You're like, "Oh, what PSI are you running?" And they, "Well, I don't know, 120, 125. You're like, why? You can read the carcass, the side of the carcass, the tyre will hold, you know, some of the tubs will hold 350 PSI in. You know, they've been tested to that limit.
But that's the holding inside the tub. That's not on a rim.
No, that's the thing.
A lot of rims, a lot of manufacturers say 120.
120 or 115 being the max.
Yeah.
But a lot of the time, you know, a 95 to 100 gets you a fantastic ride quality.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in any conditions.
Particularly longer, because I think longer, people sort of see aero and fast as being, "Oh yeah, I've really got to get the get the PSI up to really roll well." But if it's a bumpy course and you're sat on that bike for 5, 6, 7 hours. That 125 PSI is just going to rattle you.
Yeah, that's
and it's almost like the last thing people think about. And they want this, you know, comfy, aero-fast bike. It's like the tyres are the most important bit of it.
Yeah, definitely. But again, all this is so difficult when you kind of when you rock up at race day going, "Right, nutrition, I've got bike, helmet, goggles, running shoes.
What time do I start?
Nutrition, what time do I start? Where have I wrapped my bike? What number am I? Tire pressures."
Yeah. So, or the sporty, they've changed it. Which way does it go now?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is one of those things. But it is worth, you know, using this time of year to experiment on things like that. Not just always, you know, do different routes, but try slightly different pressures. Try different goggles. Try somebody else's running shoes. By trying different things and sometimes realising that your shoes are absolutely rubbish, they are like running on clogs, they're not at all taking any absorption of the foot hitting the floor, or the fact that yes, you do just tend to ride always super high pressure, and that's why, you know, you've got fillings falling out and you bounce over everything that comes along.
That's it.
I think we're done.
Well, that was a subject on tyres, which I think now we're pretty good on.
Only a little bit, crikey. So, defending the people saying there was a lot on tyres, we were doing various subjects on tyres there, including rolling resistance, tyre pressure, choice, value for money.
Getting like a tyre fix. Oh, dear.
Okay, thank you for listening. We are approximately an hour and 10 minutes in when Henry's done the little jingles and bits and pieces. Contact us with your questions, please. If you click contact at coachjoebeer.com and send the little form in. Also, you can do it through the Twitter feed, so @CoachJoeBeer. Also, you can contact Martin at @SouthFork Racing.
Yes.
Okay. Just to say, Twitter feed, I don't get into conversations on Twitter. I use Facebook for that. So if you want a conversation on something, go to Facebook, @CoachJoeBeer. Twitter's my one-way info that goes out. I don't try not to do two-way things, because Twitter's meant to be a quick look, there it goes, I've finished, not start getting into a two-way conversation. Newsletter going out next week. One went out 3 weeks ago, so there'll be one next week. And yes, just keep it coming. There's still some questions we've yet to get to, but if you can send them in, this is the September issue, if you can send them in with your questions that are relevant to October.
We can do just a question session if we need to.
We could do just a question session. Yeah. We won't talk about chains. We won't talk about tyres. We won't talk about goggles. I might be getting a couple of interviews done in the next couple of weeks. What are you nodding at me for?
I'm just wondering who they were.
Who they were. We mentioned somebody's name earlier, I think. So
yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be two blokes in the magazine, is it?
No, not those two.
Thank the Lord.
Not those two monkeys. No, they're off now. Right. Thank you very, very much. Please enjoy the rest of your summer. There's still a bit of it to be had. I still think September's summer-ish. It's not autumn.
Well, I thought you were going to say the W word.
I didn't say it.
We've had an agreement.
I've had,
Oh, I might have said it already. Oh, no.
No. So, yes, enjoy the rest of your season. Please keep the questions coming. Make the most of it. At some point, 2013, for most of us, we'll have a line drawn under it, and we can reminisce and plan our daring do's for 2014. The moment, we will say, train smart, have fun, and we will speak to you in a month's time.
Goodbye. Big issue.
Thanks, Martin. That's brilliant. That's what a great.
Doing?
Well, I hope Henry puts this at the end. That's all I can say. Because if you do it at the beginning, I don't know.
Are we running through it? Are we?
Yes. No, we're just doing a test.
Oh, test.
Test.
Test. 1, 2, 2.